So, I'll go ahead and call this meeting to order at 4:02 p.m. and we'll do roll call. Kind of all be here. Steve Robbins?
Here.
Andy Bastis?
Here.
Don Woodruff?
Here.
Jesse Helmer?
Here.
Mike McDougall?
Here.
Ben Zunabe?
Here.
Sonia Sager?
Here.
Shalia Solomon?
Here.
Okay, we have a quorum. I would just like to introduce our guests. I think we have Jeff Wallace on the line. Department of Fish and Game biologist. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good evening, everybody.
And Fred West. And Fred, can you just let us know your title and what you're going to speak on?
Yeah. I'm Fred West. I'm the summer season research biologist with the Department of Fish and Game Commercial Fisheries Division. And we're going to be talking about our upcoming planned ichthyophonus sampling project. And there's other representatives from the state that are going to be part of that discussion as well. Thanks.
And I think we have Marcy Okada here from the National Park Service.
Hi, Karma. This is Marcy. My apologies. I'm just on the phone line.
That's fine. And Marcy, guys, we're going to, you wanted to discuss something on the agenda. I think we will. Oh, we do have it on there, the compendium.
Yep. I'm just going to provide a quick update on our Yukon Charlie compendium.
Okay. The rest of the guests online, can we just go through and can you let us know who you are and who you're with?
Hi, Karma and everyone else. This is Brooke McDavid with the Subsistence Division of Fish and Game.
Hi, Brooke.
Happy New Year, Brooke. This is Ben.
Happy New Year, Ben, and everyone else in Eagle.
Hi, Karma and Ben and everybody. This is Dina Jown with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm the summer season management biologist.
Hi, Dina. Welcome.
Hey, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, everybody. This is Chuck Brazil with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm the Regional Management Coordinator for the Division of Commercial Fisheries.
I'm sorry, can you repeat your title?
Yeah, hi everybody. I'm Chuck Brazil. I'm with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and I'm the Regional Management Coordinator for the Division of Commercial Fisheries for the region.
Thank you.
Hi, folks. My name is Zach Lohr. I'm with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and I'm the Regional Research Coordinator.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Serena Fitza. I'm the Executive Director for the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association.
Hey, I'm Matt Storm, a wildlife biologist for Yukon Charlie National Preserve.
Can you hear
me,
everyone?
I'm Chrissy Gleason with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm the Yukon River Fall Season Manager.
If I could ask all the managers and Department of Fish and Game, can you please put your name and title in the chat? It makes it a lot easier when we're trying to put the meeting minutes together. Is there anyone else?
Good afternoon, Chair Karma and AC members. My name is Bruce Irvin. I work for the Tanana Chiefs Conference and the Tribal Resources Stewardship Program. Glad to be here today. Thank you for letting me attend.
Welcome, Bruce.
Good evening. This is Jody Lazzori. I'm with 80th and Jim Comfish. I'm the regional soil biologist.
Welcome.
I'm called Mr. Lester.
Yeah, it's a little hard to write. Okay.
Sorry.
It's a little hard to write these down. So if we can, if all of you online could put your name in the chat, that would be great.
Carl Pfister, Alaska Department of Fish and Game Regional Sonar Coordinator, and I'm adding it to the chat as well.
Oh, thank you so much. Welcome.
Hello, my name is Jamie Ferguson, and I'm the fish pathologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And I put that in the chat.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chief Albee and advisory committee members. My name is Jim Simon. I'm a consultant with the Tanana Chiefs Conference Tribal Resources Stewardship Program. Thank you.
Hi, Jim. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Any others?
Hi, I'm Shane Ransbury. I'm with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm Christie's assistant for fall season.
Welcome, Shane. Is that it? Okay. And if we want to go around the room here in the tribal hall in Eagle Village, if you want to say your name and your AC member.
This is Don Woodruff. I'm the AC member from Eagle and on the Eastern Federal Subsistence Rec.
Nathan Becker, subsistence user, DPSO.
Thank you.
Steve Robbins, vice chair.
Jackie Homer, member.
Yes. No, just say.
Ben Junby.
All right. So, if that's everyone, we'll go ahead and move on to approval of the agenda. If I could get a motion to approve the agenda.
I'll make the motion to approve the agenda.
I would like to add the Denison Project under new business under Yukon Charlie Rivers. And before the game proposal. Does anyone else have any additions to the agenda?
Karma, Andy?
Yes.
Yeah, if we have time, it's not critical at this point, but if we have time, I think it would be good for this AC to identify statewide proposals that are coming before the Board of Game, just so that we can identify those so that ADF and D staff can get a heads up at our next meeting to have some presentations or be able to comment on those fours. If we have time, but I think we have a pretty full agenda. I just think it might help with our next meeting if we can identify those at this meeting. That's all.
Okay. I think Kyle has the list of them. We could go through them, check them off, I think. Is that correct, Kyle?
Hi, Karma. Yes, that's correct. Excuse me. I was just on another phone call and finishing up my lunch. I attached in the one of the distributions I sent out to you and the other members, and they're also posted to that online public meeting notice, which I'll drop a link to in the chat for those of you who are online right now. That should have all of the attachments, including that meeting minutes template that has the list of all of those upcoming statewide proposals that Andy just mentioned. And as I told you earlier, I'd be happy to put those up on screen if you get to those in the meeting so that folks can see the proposals as we're moving through them.
Madam Chair, Andy, if let's at the end of the new business, and if we're just running out of time, we have time, we can do that at another meeting.
Okay, that sounds good. Is there any additions to the agenda? Not hearing any? All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay. Approval of the previous meeting minutes. If you guys want to take a minute to take a look at that, it's in the meeting minutes tab, for August 23rd meeting.
I'd like to make a motion.
Steve makes the motion to approve the minutes. Don Woodruff seconds it. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Okay. Any AC comments or concerns? Don?
I have a concern about the lack of return of salmon, both Chinook and Chowman. Seems to me that it's not improving, and the age composition is decreasing, and it's becoming more and more apparent that we don't really foresee a bright future for our fish racks and for our dogs and for our smokehouses, and it's just kind of depressing in the respect that it hampers our subsistence lifestyle so badly that it's just crying shame.
Thank you, Don.
Herman, Andy.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I want to support what Don said and also add to that. I'm starting a preliminary survey of dog mushers in the Eagle area to kind of get an idea of what the impacts are of no-fall chum to the subsistence lifestyle for dog mushers up here. And I'll be reporting at our next meeting with some of those preliminary results. But right now it's looking like the economic hardship for people for trying to maintain a dog sled team is astronomical and unsustainable under the current fishing conditions on the Yukon River. And the reason I bring this point is that a big part of what Alaska subsistence, traditional Alaska subsistence in remote villages used to rely a lot on dog teams, and I think we're going to see a major decline in dog mushing for people other than maybe those that want to race. And I think that's really it's a shame. It's, I think people identify Alaska, the identity of Alaska, as hunting, fishing, trapping, dog mushing. And to lose that in the state is pretty much unforgivable. And I know everyone is trying to figure out what's going on, but I just want to state we don't have too many years of poor fishing before there will be no more dog teams in rural Alaska. So that's the concern I want to voice. Thank you, Carmen. Thank you, Don.
Okay. This is Karma. I would also like to, I do have concerns also very much of, and the low returns on salmon. This never seems like we get any answers as to, I know there's so many different reasons why they're not coming back, but I'm really concerned that we need to really try to look into these and get some answers. It's very sad for our way of life, our food source out here. I just can see it all going away. So.
Hi, Karma.
Yes.
This is Mike McDougall. I have some concerns with some of the sampling proposals that we're going to hear from the department later in the meeting. And I've drafted a draft resolution in advance for discussion that is along the lines of some of the concerns that I'm hearing now. And I would just like to go ahead and read the draft proposal and so that we can put it out there for discussion.
Okay. So on the agenda, we do have the Ixtiofauna sampling project where they're going to kind of give us an overview of that. We can either put it there or you can read it now.
I'd like to go ahead and read it now just so people maybe have an idea of some of our concerns here, and then after the presentation, we can discuss it further.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
Okay. So, we, the Eagle Advisory Committee, with respect to the proposals of lethal sampling of Chinook salmon on the Yukon River drainage, deliver the following resolution. Whereas we recognize that the Chinook salmon of the Yukon River are in unprecedented decline, whereas recent Chinook runs have failed to meet escapement treaty obligations with Canada or subsistence needs, whereas subsistence fishers were unable to fish for salmon at all during 2021, whereas roughly 600 Chinook salmon proposed to be killed overall, including the 200 proposed to be killed at the Eagle Sonar, comprise a great portion of the subsistence needs of the upper Yukon. Whereas the Eagle Sonar has worked hard to ensure extremely low casualties of Chinook during data collection. Whereas lethal Chinook sampling at Eagle Sonar in 2018 was controversial. Whereas subsistence fishers value their way of life, which can only continue if they can fish for themselves above receiving dead fish from lethal sampling leftovers. Whereas we encourage Fish and Game to explore all non-lethal means of studying Ixtiofauna. Therefore, be it resolved that the Eagle Advisory Committee opposes the lethal sampling of Chinook salmon drainage wide. And that's the end of the draft resolution. So maybe we can think about those things while we're hearing the presentation from the department. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Any more concerns or comments from the AC? Okay, moving on, we'll go to public comments or concerns. Okay, not hearing any. We'll move on to new business. And the first is sheep on Glacier Mountain. And if I could have Don explain a little bit about that, and then we'll have Jeff Wells speak on that.
Thank you, Carmen. Last year, BLM called me on the phone and asked me what I thought about the commercial harvest of sheep on Glacier Mountain. And they had two guys that wanted to take clients in there and harvest bull for sheep. And they told me that they only saw three bull corral in their last survey. So it kind of paused me for a minute, and I said, well, what's the chance of rotating them once a year, and then they'll only take a third of the sheep? And seems the numbers are so low, and from everything I've heard from Yukon Flats area, there's increasing icing events as the weather changes over the past 10 years or so. And so I requested that another survey be done and see if we can get a handle on the exact numbers. I know that Yukon Charlie has a fair number of sheep, but it's quite a long ways from Glacier Mountain. And I know the sheep like that above timberline country to stay safe from the wolves. So maybe Jeff Wells can help us a little bit on that last survey. Thank you.
Adam Chair, can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, now.
Okay, you guys got me all right?
Yes.
Okay, and just one thought, just thinking about who's online, Karma, I don't think the Glacier Mountain discussion will take too long. As far as my moose update, I'd be happy to wait until the end for that. I think the number of fisheries people online far outweigh us wildlife folks, so I'm going to be on to a bitter end because of you guys is potentially talking about statewide proposals. So just a thought, but I'm happy to cover the Glacier Mountain stuff here. I don't think it'll take too long. So I'm just going to share I have just two slides related to Glacier Mountain here. Okay, you guys can you see that?
Yep.
Yeah, we can.
Okay. Now you're seeing the full view of the map?
Yeah.
Great. So just to make sure we're all on the same page, when we're talking about Glacier Mountain area, you know, the Glacier Mountain controlled use area, as you guys know, encompasses a broader area than where sheep are typically located. And so this area in yellow shows the entire Glacier Mountain controlled use area. And then this area with the crosshatch blue, you know, this covers Glacier Mountain and Mount Eldridge. And that's when we do a survey and when we think about sheep within Glacier Mountain area, that's the area that we cover during the survey. Not saying sheep don't go outside of this area, and they certainly do. But this is during crosshatch. So, and then just jumping right into it, and this is a busy graph, so I'm going to walk through it. But these are the results of our minimum count surveys, and we haven't conducted surveys in every year, but we conducted minimum count surveys between 2000 and 2005, and then again 2012 to current, other than we did not conduct a survey in 2020. The 2021 survey, that was actually funded by BLM. We are the ones that conducted it. And then 1 year going back, I believe it was 2019 or 2018, Park Service actually conducted the survey as part of their broader Yukon Charlie survey. So definitely kind of a cooperative effort. So to walk through what the different colors mean, the green represents the total number of sheep
that were observed. Going down to the orange, that represents total number of ewes, and it also includes ewe-like, so young rams. And it's pretty tough to tell the smaller rams from ewes during surveys. The white line represents the total number of rams that we observed, and then the bottom, or what's on bottom most of the time, is the total number of lambs that we observed. So, as you can see, it jumps around a fair amount when you look at these numbers. If you look at all these years, the average number of sheep that we see, or have seen on any given survey, is 87. When you look at 2021, that's here at the end. Can you guys see my mouse?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So if you look here in 2021, you'll notice the green dot is well below 2019. That's the last year we surveyed, and it's the lowest number we've observed during any given year. So 2021, we observed a total of 22 sheep. The next lowest was these years around 2013 and 2016, which is in the 60s. Out of these, 22 sheep isn't a lot to begin with, so obviously we didn't see a lot of lambs. Out of the rams that we did observe, we observed a total of, one that we thought was potentially legal. So, in thinking about this, obviously, when you guys look at this, you might be alarmed, but there's a few things to think about and potential explanations as to why we observed fewer sheep. One, it's important to keep in mind that these are minimum count surveys, so this is a minimum number. We don't estimate. It's not a statistical estimate. It's just we go out and count, and this is what we observe. So there's a potential that we miss sheep during the survey. I don't think it's very likely we miss any bigger groups. Usually those bigger groups are fairly visible, but certainly potential that we miss some sheep during the survey. Obviously, another potential is there was a decrease in the population. Third potential is that potentially sheep move to areas that were nearby but outside of the primary survey area. So we know that sheep in the Tanana uplands, so that includes Glacier Mountain, sheep in Yukon Charlie, Mount Harper, the sheep that sometimes are around Eagle there. We know these sheep use cliff faces that are down in the trees. So potentially some of these sheep move to lower elevation areas or some of these cliff areas that we don't survey. So that's another potential. Another potential is that potentially some movement between Glacier Mountain and some of these other areas of sheep habitat. Like Don mentioned, the primary sheep habitat in Yukon Charlie is quite a ways away from Glacier Mountain, but perhaps there's some interchange there. Without collared sheep in there, we really don't know the answer to that. This is the only survey conducted in the Tanana uplands this past summer. So, and Matt Storm can speak to this, but I believe Yukon Charlie is planning on conducting a survey next year. Usually, Fish and Game conducts a survey at Mount Harper. They did not this year because of reduced funding. So this is all we have for Tanana uplands for this year. And I think the main point here, there were not a lot of sheep there that we saw this year, but there's a lot of variability between these surveys from year to year, and I think another survey next year is going to be very telling. The other piece of information in terms of harvest, if you look at the long-term average over this 21-year time period, or 22 years actually, back to 2000, so the average harvest per year is just under 2 rams. It ranges from 0 to, we had one year where there's 5 rams harvested. Over the last 5 years, it's ranged from 0 to 4. Average is exactly the same as the long-term average. And in 2021, there was 2 rams harvested out of Glacier Mountain. And that's not abnormal, where the number of legal rams we observe doesn't match necessarily with what was harvested. In some years, what was harvested is greater than what we have observed. And that just, I think, speaks to, maybe we're judging some of these sheep wrong. This year, I don't think so, just because there weren't that many rams. But it speaks to that these sheep are doing some things that we're not seeing everything, or they're in other areas when we do the survey. So that's kind of the brief update I have, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Hey, Jeff, this is Steve Robin. When are the surveys, when are they concluded? Do they start and finish? Is it a time period? Is it a week?
And what time frame are they done in? What month are they done in?
Yeah, good question, Steve. So we typically don't start our seed surveys until beginning of July, and that's mostly because a couple of reasons. One, we want enough snow to be melted. You know, if there's a lot of snow up there, we're going to miss sheep because obviously sheep are white. So that's part of the reason. The other reason is just to be consistent amongst years. You know, if we did a survey earlier in June, even if snow is melted, quite a bit of lamb mortality can occur during those first 4 to 6 weeks of lamb's life. So just to keep things consistent, we don't do it until July, sometimes as late as early August. And the Glacier Mountain Sheep Survey, it takes a total of about 2 hours to, once we get there, about 2 hours to fly it. So it's a, you know, a short time period.
Irma, I have a question, Andy.
Okay.
Well, Jeff, can you tell us of the, do you have your harvest data broken down into guided and commercial hunts versus private hunts?
Yeah, that's a good question, Andy. I'm going to stop sharing and go to my other spreadsheet here and see what I found available offhand. So I don't have that data summarized. I will say that I don't know. I can't see the 21-21 harvest, but I don't know of a sheep that's been harvested by a guided hunter since it's been quite a few years. There was 1 or 2 years where the guide went in there and harvested maybe 1 or 2, but it's been quite a few years.
And if I could follow up, Don's questions or concerns on this. Don, is this something that when you were contacted, was this something that they were asking for your input on whether or not to allow guides to come in there or to increase guided hunting? I wasn't really clear on what.
From what I understand from Jim Harrigan, there has been one guide that pulled a Glacier Mountain off his itinerary because of lack of harvestable sheep. I think that to me that sheep are an indicator species of what's happening in the environment. And if we don't have harvestable sheep and we don't have caribou this winter, it compounded by lack of fish, it just eliminates any resources that are out there on the fringe for us to harvest. And I don't think that commercial harvest should have priority. So being that it's a federal area managed by BLM, there's a couple processes, one called the 804 processes, that makes it closed to everyone that's not federally qualified subsistence hunter. And then there's the 815 process that closes it completely. And I wouldn't advocate that at all. And I would entertain perhaps cutting the harvest timeline down by half, say, and see if we can't get our sheep population up. And I know that sheep hunters want to be there on opening day because sheep get a little bit more wary as the season goes on. And I think that not to infringe on the youth hunt, that's an important part of raising our children and teaching them the proper way to harvest meat. And we'll see what comes down the road.
Thank you, Don. Any more comments?
I have one more.
Okay, Steve.
Hey, Jeff, it's Steve Rollins again. On your RAM count, when you're saying RAM, that is a legal RAM, not just a used RAM, correct?
So Steve, on that graph I shared, that was total. The line for RAM represented total RAMs that we observed. So all classes of RAMs, all ages of RAMs.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Permit Jim Simon has his hand up.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you, Karma. I just wanted to raise an issue that the advisory committee or S.C. Brooke McDavid from the subsistence section of the state is on this call. The department and the Board of Game have yet to make a customary and traditional use determination for Dall sheep in this area. The only determinations that have been made in Unit 20 is a negative CNT finding for the Toke management area and the Delta management area. But to my knowledge, a customary and traditional worksheet has not been presented to the Board of Game to determine whether or not sheep in 20E associated with customary and traditional uses under the state system. The Federal Subsistence Board has determined that sheep in 20E on federal public lands are associated with customary and traditional uses. So it is a federal subsistence resource, but that provision of Alaska Statute 1605-258 has not yet been accomplished by the Board of Game, such that the Board of Game has yet to determine whether or not reasonable opportunities are being provided for state subsistence uses in that area, if that is called for, if they make a positive customary and traditional use determination. So the Eagle Advisory Committee or the Department of Fish and Game could submit a proposal to make a CNT determination for Dall sheep in 20E. It doesn't need to happen only in regular Region 3 cycle, consistent with 5 AAC 96.615, which is the subsistence proposal policy, which indicates that whenever a customary and traditional use determination has yet to be made, that can be brought forward to the Board of Game at any time, as long as a proposal to do so is submitted in a timely manner. So that is something that the Eagle Advisory Committee and the department should probably put on their list of future action items. Thank you.
Possibly cutting down on that time that it's harvested and leaving it for customary and traditional use, right? The state.
I think Jim is correct that the state could support us with an AC, customary and traditional use determination. We did put in for a customary traditional use determination through the federal process about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, because I had a foresight that perhaps some of our resources that are close to home were being depleted. And if you look in your federal hunting regulations, it shows the different units that have harvested sheep there in the past. And so they're on the customary and traditional use determination for federal, which basically is Toke and Delta and the surrounding communities that are not urban. Fairbanks is not one of them. Thank you.
Hi, this is Brooke McDavid with Subsistence Division. We'd be happy to, you know, work with the Eagle AC if you all are interested in putting in a proposal for a C&T finding to the board. You can let us know. We can provide, you know, harvest information that we have from our subsistence surveys, especially the ones we did recently there in Eagle. And, yeah, if anyone wants to get in touch, you can contact myself or Caroline Brown, our leader trainer.
I did contact Alita, and she's going to send us the survey results. So. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, so we'll put that down. Yeah, we'll put that as an action item we'll work on. Okay.
Do you know that number, Don, 16 points that Jim was referring to?
I don't
know. Could we ask him?
I didn't write that down. Maybe we just copied.
Jim, can you repeat that number? It's a statute?
It's a regulation 5AAC96.25, and I'll put it in the chat also.
Yeah, I got that.
Okay. Was that not the one you needed?
No, there was one before then.
He said there was one before then that was 16.
Oh, the statute. That's just the state subsistence statute, which is Alaska statute 16.05.258. So basically what that statute says is that prior to providing any hunt opportunities under the state system, the Board of Game is first supposed to determine whether or not that repopulation is associated with customary and traditional subsistence uses, and then, if so, make regulations that provide a reasonable opportunity for the normally diligent subsistence user to participate with a reasonable expectation of success.
Thank you. Any more comments? We'll put that down in our action items to work on that. Go ahead, Andy.
Oh, sorry, Don. This is Jeff Wells. While you guys were talking, I looked up to answer Andy's question. So in the last 10 years, so since 2012, there's been 2 sheep harvested by hunters who were guided. It was one in 2012 and one in 2013. So nothing since 2013 by a guided hunter.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, if there's not any more comments on that, we'll move on to no cap on chum buyback. And Don, would you mind? Yes, go ahead.
Real quick, this is Kyle, the board support coordinator. I'm just about to send some information to you and the other members. You were asking earlier about the process for submitting proposals, and it sounded like there's a comment earlier. So I'm going to post that in the chat here as well, but I'm sending you all the information on, because there is a call for proposals out in the Board of Fisheries now for next year's meeting cycle, which will include Arctic, Yukon, Kuskokwim, and fish. So I'm sending you that information now so you have it.
Okay, thank you. So, real quick, Jeff, you were saying there's a lot of fish biologists and stuff online that maybe we should go ahead and talk through the fisheries topic.
Yeah, I'm happy to wait and do my moose update, you know, after the fisheries stuff, if that works for you guys, just because of the number of fisheries folks online.
Okay, that sounds good. So we'll do no cap on chum biotech, the ich sampling project, and then any fisheries, fisheries and salmon and old business. So go ahead. Don was going to talk briefly on the no cap on some bycatch.
Thank you, Governor. This summer I participated with your teleconferences about the North Pacific Management Council's management of bycatch, whether it be chum or chinook. And there's a hard cap on the chinook bycatch. It's like 45,000. And when they approach that number, they have to leave the area that they're fishing in, and they make that, they call that a saving area, and they have to move out of there, because if they reach that cap, they got to stop fishing. They don't ever want to do that. But there is no bycatch on chum. And to quote Grandma Sarah from Eagle, she said, as a backup, we always have jarred salmon under our bunk. And I think that's to be respected, that we listen to what our elders said and not just sort of let it drift by our brain, and have some respect for their knowledge and their years of use. So I'm personally kind of upset with the 500,000 number that was the bycatch for chum. And I would really like to see any of that bycatch go to the, you know, the food banks and get processed back to the people. But I understand that's not an easy thing for these catcher boats to do, but it's the right thing, and it's the proper thing for the resource. And so I would like to get some feedback from Fish and Game, and also send a letter to the commissioner that sits on the North Pacific Management Council to support us and get some fish back upriver. It's pitiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Hi, Mandy.
Yes.
Thank you. So something that Virgil Umpenhauer has been talking about for 20 years is the Area NM, as in Mickey, intercept fisheries. And there, in years past, many years past, they used to keep track of what the bycatch was there, and they did genetic sampling of those fish, and we're getting somebody else talking. Basically, they did genetics, and they were able to determine that there was a fair amount of salmon returning back to Western Alaska and the Yukon River. And I think there's been some discussion and some push to try and get that genetic sampling done again, and maybe managers or some of the ADF and fish staff can update us on what's being done, if anything is going to be done along those lines, and if not, what process needs to be taken to reenact genetic sampling and institution of a bycatch in the Area M fisheries, because in the past that has been identified as an intercept fisheries for Western Alaskan stocks, some returning to the Yukon. That's all I have. Thank you. I guess I'm asking if there's any ADF and JV fish people on board right now that can update us on the status of that, or what it would take to get that going again for genetic sampling and or institution of a bycatch sap in Area M.
Yeah, sure thing, Andy. Hi, everybody. For the record, my name is Chuck Brazil. I'm the Regional Management Coordinator for the Division of Commercial Fish for the AYK region. That's a really good question, Andy. And right now what I can tell you is those conversations are taking place at the fishery scientist level and the commissioner's level. So I know that there's something in the works. I just don't have any additional details beyond that. But I know there's involved discussion at this point, and we'll have more information in the future.
And can you let our AC know if the people on the Yukon River or Western Alaska would like to see a bycatch cap put on that? What is the process for that? Who do they need to speak to? Where would the proposal need to go? Is that a Board of Fish issue, or is that National Marine Council?
Yeah, Andy, that's a really intuitive question. So that's a state-managed fishery in South Peninsula. It's in a different region outside of ours. However, South Peninsula fisheries are having their regular board cycle next spring. I think it coincides right after ours. And so you can submit a proposal to the Board of Fisheries right now for that board meeting to whatever effect that, you know, how you would like to see that fishery, you know, implemented or managed. The board process to submit proposals is open through April 11th. So you could submit a proposal for the Alaska Peninsula fisheries to how you'd like to see that fishery managed. Was that helpful?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and to follow up on that, I want to add a little bit of information. And if you guys need, you know, if anybody needs assistance, you know, with the proposals, you can talk to the AC coordinator there, who coordinates the ACs for your area, or, you know, you can talk to our area managers, Dina and Christy, and they can point you in the right direction, maybe to who you might want to talk to out of the Kodiak office, you know, to submit, help you write those proposals how you want it, so that the language that you see in your mind as you envision it gets down on paper.
Copy. Thank you.
All right, you bet. Have a good night. Thanks.
What region was that cycle will go through again? Sorry.
Yeah, so that's Alaska Peninsula. It's in the Westward region, and the area manager for that fishery is Lisa Fox.
Oh, wow, we know her.
She's an old resident of Eagle.
Yeah.
Yes, she is, yeah. And you can talk to Jeff Waddle as well. I think he's the management coordinator.
Can we get a hold of you possibly for that contact information, or is that online?
Yeah, you could get a hold of me for that. Or you can get a hold of any of the other area managers like Christy or Dina, and they have access to that in the state employee directory as well. So, you know, all three of us would be good contacts to get either Lisa or Jeff's phone number to, you know, get a hold of them.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Karma? Hi.
I have one thing to add.
Go ahead, Don.
Okay. In 2007, I went to Nome and testified to the North Pacific Mariners Council for the Eastern Wrasse. And it was kind of intimidating, but I got up and gave my speech. And at that time, we were trying to establish a cap on the Chinook. And after hearing the testimony from all the Western Alaska fishermen, I put in my two bits for the chum as well. Well, that was a long time ago, and the only thing we got was a cap on the Chinook, and we're still in the same hole, it seems like, even with a cap on the Chinook, so I don't know. It doesn't seem to be working.
Through the chair, this is Chuck Brazil again. Would you mind if I gave you Jeff's phone number?
No, go ahead.
Okay, it's area code 907-486-1813.
And that's Jeff?
Jeff Waddle, W-A-D-L-E. He's the management coordinator for that fishery. And if you would like Lisa's number, I could give that to you right now as well.
Yes, please.
It's 486-1874.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
If I could have a question, not as cell phone efficient most. So does Fishing Game, do they have an emergency closure of any sort? If we don't have a cap, I mean, at what point are we going to fish let these fish get bycatch or bycall? Is there a trip that's going to shut it off and say we're done until we get these numbers back? I mean, is there something? I know we're trying to put a cap on it, but is there a cap in place now that? To where we don't catch the very last chum before it gets in, or we're going to wait until we catch the last chum, and then, oh crap, we should have put a cap on it. I mean, is there something in place before Eagle AC decides to finally put a cap on it?
Steve, Andy, I might be able to help you a little bit. And correct me if I'm wrong, ADF&G staff, but I believe in the past, the Area M fisheries did have a cap on it, and due to this very concern we're dealing with now. However, the cap was removed. I don't remember what year it was. That led to a lot of concerns of what was termed plum chucking. So they're after a different species of fish, but they catch a lot of chum salmon, and boats were monitored, and there was some evidence that some boats would actually throw their bycatch overboard so that they didn't have to report it. Because once the bycatch limit for chum salmon was hit, the fishery closed, and it's an extremely lucrative fisheries for other types of salmon. So my recollection of where we used to be is there was a cap, and that the Board of Fish removed that cap at some point in time, and maybe what needs to be done is to reinstate that cap. And if I'm wrong, someone please speak up and correct me, but I think that's what the history of that fisheries is.
Hey, Andy, this is Chuck Brazil with the Department of Fish and Game. I can address that question for you. You pretty much kind of nailed it in your statement there. So, you know, after the previous chum crash, there was a cap. And then I believe once the run started to rebound and became more stable, that I don't remember the exact years or the dates, but, you know, that cap was removed. And so there's no longer a cap for chum salmon in that area of fishery.
Thank you, Chuck. You know, and I think maybe that's the easiest for this topic to be addressed because there was a cap. So maybe asking the Board of Fish to reinstitute that, given the climate change issues and the lack of fall chum and summer chum making it to Western Alaska, and food security issues. Those are the areas that I would identify as the reason to ask for this cap. It's obvious to me that there's a lot changing in the ocean, the marine environment, that's impacting the Yukon River salmon runs. We don't know all of those factors. Very likely we won't know for quite a long time what's contributing to that. So in my mind, if there's ever a time to really tighten the reins on high production fisheries and bycatch, until we have more information on it, I think that's the prudent thing to do. And, you know, I just want to clarify whether it's game or whether it's fish, the biggest issue that all rural communities are going to face over the next 10 years is food security. Some of it is caused by climate change. Some of it is caused by industry. And some of it might be impacted by increasing hunting in the state, particularly, in my mind, by non-residents. It's very attractive for people. So these are all issues that rural Alaska is going to have to unify and try and address. But, you know, salmon spend the vast majority of their life cycle out in the marine environment, and it's the one area we actually have the very least amount of information about the hard science. I mean, we're learning, but we really don't have a good idea. It's just a huge ocean, and it's pretty hard to understand the complexities of their species interactions. So that's all I have to say, but I really think that we should try and get those caps reinstituted during these runs, because, you know, it's one thing to lose king salmon, but I can remember when I came to Eagle, for many, many years, I never even caught a king salmon. I relied on chum salmon, gold chum, for both my human food and my dog food. And to lose king salmon is really bad. To lose all chum destroys our subsistence lifestyle out here in our community. And really, you know, if I had to pick one or the other, I would much rather have the fall chum available to us, because that sustains our lifestyle. We can always hunt moose and caribou and bears, but we can't feed those animals to our dogs. And so if we want to maintain dog teams as a subsistence lifestyle out here, traditional lifestyle, we must have at least a reasonable amount of fall chum for harvest. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Steve?
So I just want to follow up. I would like to know what that cap was and what year it was taken off. I mean, somebody knows the numbers.
That might be hard to find right now, Steve, but I think that could be provided to our AC. It seemed to me it was somewhere in the like 2008, 2009, 2010, somewhere right around there is when it went off, I think. But we had a tremendous chum crash right at the turn of the decade, at 1998 and 1999 were disastrous runs for chum, and so that was actually when I first got involved with this entire fisheries, is because of that. So this is a topic that's resurfacing. And maybe if ABF&G can get that to us through our coordinator or whatever, then we can use those numbers to start putting together a proposal. Thank you, Karma.
So what I'm hearing is after that chum crash, there was a cap put on the bycatch, and they rebounded. So, like, that could very much help our situation at this point. Any more comments on...
Hi, Karma. This is Brooke Woods with the Fish Commission.
Hi, Brooke.
Hi. Can you hear me okay? I'm connected by Wi-Fi.
We can.
Great. Good evening, everyone. I did want to share with you that there is an opportunity for the AC to submit an emergency petition to Board of Fish around Area M. I did talk to the AYK regional office about this summer, and the reason for a petition can be based on the abundance of another fishery, which is, you know, the Yukon River. So that is an option. I believe I talked to Forrest Brower and I also invited the Area M manager to the YERTFA teleconference so she can answer the questions of fishermen around Area M, but the state was reluctant to provide that to Yukon River fishermen. I did want to also inform the AC that NIMP did a listening session on bycatch today after an extensive amount of tribal requests and testimony to North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. Glenn Merrill stated that information from the listening session would be provided to North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. And then the last thing I wanted to provide, thank you for your time, is the Fish Commission, along with AVCP, Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission, Aleut Community of St. Paul, Bering Sea Elders Group, Kowarik, put in emergency petition to the Department of Commerce to take action on Chinook salmon bycatch and to create a cap on chum salmon. We submitted this letter December 21st, and we are supposed to hear back by January 20th. I can update you, Karma. You are a commissioner of the Fish Commission, and I appreciate all your work there as well.
Thank you.
Hi, Carmen. This is Chuck May. I have a moment to address Andy's question about the timeline for the Area M fisheries for the changes.
Yes.
Okay. So I don't have specific numbers, but I can tell you the timeline. So in 2001, there were significant changes to the South Unimak Area M fisheries management plan, and that's when they incorporated the caps that Andy had brought up earlier. And then in 2004, there were additional changes to that, and that's when, you know, those ratio or cap restrictions were lifted. I don't have the numbers, but I'm just giving you the timeline. So, you know, if Andy wants, or whomever on the AC is investigating that, they have the timeline to go back and look.
And through the chair, this is Christy Gleason with Fish and Game to kind of add on to Chuck's comments. We did put in the source of where you can find the history of the previous chum salmon cap that was on Area M, and it lists out what pages you can look at, and there's a link posted there in the chat if that's helpful. And then that way you guys have the information, you have the full history. You can talk with us further, or you can talk to Lisa Fox or Jeff Waddle about it.
And Kyle, we can go, Kyle, board support, we can go back and look at this Zoom and get those links, right?
Yes, that's correct. I've got an audio recording, and I've been, I'll save all of everything anyone's put in the chat. I've got a record of that as well.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Christy. Any more comments? Okay. Let's, if it's okay with everyone, we'll just move down to the Ichthyophonus sampling project presentation, and then we'll talk about the fisheries and salmon, if we have any more comments on that, while all the department is here. Fred West?
Yeah. Hi, everybody. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this project. There's JD is also on the line. J.D. Ferguson. He's the fish apologist for the department. And then there's Zach Lewiller is our regional research coordinator, and he's also on the line that can have or answer some questions if any come up. But the general idea for this meeting was kind of like a more of an introductory scoping meeting to the project. I don't know. We provided the flyer that was developed that had some more of the kind of the background of the project and kind of what our tentative plans are. I don't know if anybody's been able to look at that. I think it was posted to the public site. But I was going to use that kind of as a way to move through the topic. And I guess I really do appreciate everyone's concerns on the low salmon run sizes that we've seen recently. And more, this project is one way of maybe attempting to identify a possible reason why that we're not seeing the returns as expected up in the upper river. And so I guess, I don't know, folks in the upper river may not see Ichthyophonus as much as in the lower river, but it's a typical parasite, and it seems to be at its come back. I think it was, you know, identified in the early 2000s, and it's back again. And essentially, it's a fish pathogen that infects Chinook while they're feeding in the ocean. And the fish become, I guess, intensifies or becomes worse when the fish get under stress. And so, and obviously as fish move upriver, they get more stress. So Ichthyophonus, if it's bad, it gets worse if it goes up, they go upriver. And it affects the major organs, and especially the hearts. And well, I'll go into this later, but it's, can have little impact on the fish, or it can be worse, that'll weaken the body, resulting in possible mortality. So it kind of depends on the level of infection. And what kind of prompted us to start looking at this again is in 2020 and 2021, there was reports of Ichthyophonus in 2020 in the Mid River. We got some reports of high infection rates, and then so that prompted us to do some exploratory work this season at Pilot Station, and we ended up with high levels of prevalence of up in the close to 50%. And then also there was some work done of the kind of the, I guess, harvest of small mesh gear at Rapids this year, and they got some, the prevalence was 40% there, and that was in small mesh gear, so that doesn't consider like all, it's not, wasn't representative of the sampling. And so, as I mentioned, Ichthyophonus could possibly be one explanation of what's contributing to the lower run size abundance of Canadian origin Chinook at the border. And so this is one method of trying to figure out what could possibly be happening. At this point, we don't know what degree the Ichthyophonus disease is associated with mortality, but that's what we're trying to quantify with this project. We're trying to better understand the difference in estimates between what was observed in season at Pilot and comparing those with what is
happening at the border. And essentially we're trying to establish an ticket bonus monitoring program, the long-term annual funded projects, which is the pilot station sonar. That the pilot station doesn't require any additional harvests beyond the normal test fishing efforts. So they end up with test fish, and so we can sample those. This doesn't require any additional beyond just the normal test fish operations. And what's also another, one reason we were able to evaluate this project a little more is that we improved our genetic baseline or genetic methods is allowing us to, instead of just getting a general prevalence of the entire stock, we can look at, now we can identify fish of country of origin, so we can get, you know, the ichthyophonous infections of Canadian origin fish specifically. So that improves our ability to for this project. And we're also, instead of looking at just prevalence, we are also looking, which is basically the number of fish infected in the population, we're also looking at the intensity or the severity of the infection. So we're trying to get a handle on the fish that are infected, but also how badly infected. And so we know that, you know, fish are, we can identify fish in at the pilot station, but then as they move upriver, if they're stressed, then the intensity of the infection gets worse. And so we want to be able to quantify that intensity and to see if that's an indication of being able to tell mortality. And then a longer term objectives are to determine a lethal threshold that of ichthyophonous intensity that may indicate that fish are dying because of this disease. And so the proposed plan is a collaborative effort between Fish and Game, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and DFO. And the sampling is required in several key locations. Ichthyophonus in the past has been at its peak, which is near the mid-river, and where disease severity and prevalence may indicate mortality, which is near the upper river near the border. Samples near the border are critical to determine what extent ichthyophonus is leading to low runs. And I think, as others have mentioned, unfortunately, non-lethal sampling options are not available. So there aren't any sampling options that keep the fish alive, because we have to get at the internal organs to get at the samples. So, but the hope is that sacrificing Chinook to answer a research question is not something that NFMG, Fish and Wildlife Service, or DFO considers likely. It's a pretty important consideration that we don't want to be killing fish for reasons that are that's the critical reason why we're doing this. But we believe that the short-term sacrifice of Chinook salmon to collect samples is a necessary step to address a public concern, improve in-season assessment information, and better inform precautionary management. And there's another effort or way we can get more information from these fish is there's additional contributions to other agencies, other projects to get, like, for tissue samples for other reasons, such as the for stress hormones or the eggs for like fecundity levels or thymine levels. So the fish that would be sampled would be used for more than just this ichthyophonus. There's other research that would be taking place with these fish. In the flyer, our sample sizes are
between 180 to 200 fish per SAP location. And the reason that the reason that sample size is where it's at is we need, I guess we can go this, wait up those questions, but it's more of a robust sample size to get at, to be able to tell the differences between the different sites. We need a sample size that high. So sampling may begin as early as 2022 after we do all the, you know, proper consultation and outreach that we need to do. The sampling will need to take place after 3 years, but only samples from the lower river will be needed annually, if we, as a monitoring tool, but to get the kind of the some of the specifics of the project, samples need to be for up to 3 years to get the, some of the modeling work done. And I guess this meeting was more of an opportunity to let everyone know the, what we're looking at for a project. But it'd be good to set up the time to discuss this project in depth further with more details on specifics about the project. We would be open to doing it in person or virtually, but having another opportunity to talk about this project in more detail. And then one thing we've been talking about is the possibility of developing a small working group with representatives from DFO, Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife Service, and some Canadian First Nations folks and some Eagle residents to kind of co-develop logistical ideas and options for fish distribution and other options. So this is more of a introductory concept, and I guess it's open up to questions.
Fred, this is Karma. Can you tell us, like, the numbers from pilot station to Eagle, like the difference between what you guys are seeing on sonar that is of concern that they're not making it to pass the Eagle sonar?
Yeah. The last couple of years, I think it's been 20 to 30,000. Roughly, we're estimating, we're using our in-season genetics at the pilot station sonar, and so we have an estimate, and then it's a lot less than what is expected at the border, even when we consider harvest. It's been 20 to 30,000, somewhere in there.
Real quick, can I follow up on that? So you're saying that from pilot to Eagle, you're losing about, well, roughly, because of course this is so, but 20 to 30,000 fish.
Roughly, yeah. Okay. That's what our estimates are. That's based on if we use the in season on our genetic estimate at pilot. I mean, there's uncertainty around those, but those estimates, and then there's uncertainty in the harvest as well, but roughly that's about what it is. I guess Dina has her hand up. She might have a more specific number on hand.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Karma, and thanks, Fred. Yeah, I was just kind of skimming back through our season summary, and I think kind of based on genetics, we estimated in season that we saw upwards of over 60,000 Canadian origin Chinook salmon at Pilot, and then obviously we did not get that many at Eagle. You know, 66,000 Chinook salmon at Pilot, you know, that is a number that maybe could have met border, maybe could have provided for some limited subsistence openings, but because we've been having this difference between estimates, we've been having these tens of thousands of fish kind of go missing between Pilot and Eagle. We had to keep fishing closed. We had to manage very, very conservative this, you know, in recent years because something's happening to fish in rivers. So these are fish that have gotten to the ocean, survived in the ocean, survived hatchery competition, survived bycatch, survived area M, survived everything to come back to the river, get past Pilot Station sonar, and then we're not seeing them at Eagle. And even, you know, last year we didn't make escapement goals at any of our projects. And so this is a really big problem that we're trying to tackle and trying to understand. It really affects how we can manage. It means that we have to manage very, very conservatively. You know, and even then, even last year with all of the closures, complete closures for subsistence fishing, only very limited opportunity for, you know, limited opportunity for non-salmon or 4-inch or smaller nets, like we still didn't meet escapement goals. So there's kind of not much more we could have done to get more fish to the border. There's something happening to the fish between Pilot and Eagle that, you know, we really need to get a good understanding of.
Thank you. Andy?
Yeah, thank you. So I have two things I wanted to state. The first thing is I understand the reasoning for wanting to do the testing. I think it's pretty important to understand that for management of the fisheries. And I guess my first question would be, once you start to get a feel for what the dropout rate is, will you need to continue to kill and sample fish in the lower, middle, and upper, or simply the lower? And will those fish show that sign of ichneoconus enough at the lower regions? From what I remember learning about ichneoconus, it seems to develop and exacerbate the farther they go upriver, the more stress they're under. Water temperatures, warm water temperatures are affecting them. So I guess my question is, will you have to continue to kill fish at the lower river to get the samples you need into the future? And then the second thing, question, or maybe it's more of a comment, I've been thinking about this a lot. My own understanding of ichthyophonus is that it's most affected by stress conditions in fish. We've always attributed it to mainly warm water or high river flow. But I'm beginning to wonder if maybe what's really happening is that the fish are coming into the river basically with malnutrition. And so those fish that have to swim farther, longer, are stressed out because they don't have the reserves they need entering the river. And I'll basically state that, you know, this is one of the reasons that could be contributing to smaller fish at age. And so it's not always simply we fishing out the big fish. It could be the stress factor out in the marine environment that's exacerbating this. I know when Dr. Kosan did a lot of this research back in the early 2000s, we were basically saying that it's a hot water and high water event that's triggering it, but I'm beginning to wonder if it's something that we're going to be living with for a long time because we don't understand what's happening in the marine environment. So, anyway, if you could just really briefly inform me on what the long-term strategy is of monitoring ichneoconus and the impacts of having to sample long-term. Thank you.
Hey Andy, this is Dina John with Fish and Game. I'll touch on those briefly, and then Fred West and J.D. Ferguson can add more detail. But yeah, the goal would be that eventually we would just do this, I think, for 3 years, and then we would only need to sample in the lower Yukon. And those mortalities would ideally come from Pilot Station sonar and just from their regular ongoing sampling efforts. So there wouldn't be any additional fish killed. Those samples could be taken from Pilot Station sonar mortalities. That's an excellent fishery program. It uses a representative suite of large mesh sizes, and so it samples across the population. So that's a great project to keep getting those samples from after we move forward past this initial phase of the project. And I really very much appreciate your bringing up the other stress factors. There is other sampling that we're planning on having to be conducted. Fred mentioned the thiamine work. We're also coordinating with Sabrina Garcia to collect additional samples in the lower Yukon, looking at things like stomach contents and stress hormones and such, you know, egg fecundity and egg quality, that sort of thing. So any samples that we get will hopefully try to address some of these other points. We do take temperature readings at projects, and last year hot water was not a concern, but we obviously need to kind of keep an eye on what's stressing fish going forward. I don't know, JD, if you want to add anything more about how just the samples from the lower Yukon shake out and how you can see ick in fish that are lower enough in the river so it's not really visually present. JD might be able to add a little bit more context to that.
Sure, Dina. I can add a little bit on that. Like Dina had stated, is, you know, the long-term monitoring goal aspect of this is to use handling mortality from the pilot station and sonar. So those fish are already dead, and we're trying to maximize the usefulness of those fish and study, you know, use them to study as much as we can. And they are representative of the run based on how the projects run. But basically the idea is that, you know, as many of you know, the fish get infected in the marine environment, and then they come into the river, and as folks have touched on, the infection will like ramp up as the fish migrate through this long distance and in a stressful environment, you know, high flow, warm water, whatever the other stressors will be on a given year, and as you know they're breaking down and the parasite just proliferates, you know, as these fish are migrating up river. And so the idea would be to look at for those pilot fish, the fish come in with like a set number of infections from the ocean, right? And so, if a fish comes in with, say, 10, just for example, say 10 parasites versus 100 parasites, well, the one with more parasites coming in would likely end up having more parasites as they migrate up. And so what we're trying to do is, you know, based on data further upriver, using statistics, try and correlate what those infections are and account for that ramping up to mid-river. And so we can get an idea of, what's a low versus a high infection that the fish is coming in with, so that we know that would indicate, like my example with 100 parasites, that fish would likely end up with more parasites as it migrates up than one with just one or two parasites, assuming they're all subjected to the same stressors and whatnot because they are migrating as a cohort population. And so so that's the idea, is to use the initial infections that the fish come in at and parse out, the high versus low infections and see what that correlates to further up river. And then we don't have to look up river every year, you know. We'll have the modeling and the statistics to show, fish that come in with this X number of parasites, as those fish with that infection level migrate up to mid-river, this is the level that they get to, which is really high, versus high enough that's associated with mortality. With our testing procedure and model, versus one that comes in with Y infections that may ramp up as well, but not to the level where it's associated with a lethal infection. And so comparing infection levels at different sites is important for doing that. And then looking at further upriver, where the so-called survivors are, is important because there's an analysis, it's a retrospective analysis, where you plot out the frequency of infections in the fish population that we can use to estimate parasite-associated mortality. And it's a pretty well-established technique in parasitology. I mean, it was, I think, introduced in the 1970s, and, you know, lots of researchers have used it. So they are, you know, vetted methods, but it's just a different... We're using different methods this go around than, as Frank had mentioned, or sorry, Fred had mentioned, just looking at prevalence. Now we want to actually quantify infections and figure out how high of an infection is associated with a lethal infection. And using these different approaches, we could do that. And so, yeah, hopefully that answers your questions. That was, yeah, long term, we just want to look at those handling mortalities that can indicate high versus low infections that would ramp up to a lethal level once we, you know, figure out those correlations.
Karma, follow-up question,
please. Hi, Karma. This is Sonia Hager.
Go ahead, Andy. Sonia, you're next.
Yeah, quickly, are there same issues with Echinocomus on the Cuscatin River, and are there other rivers there aren't too many long rivers in Alaska other than the Kuskokwim in Alaska, I'm sorry, the Yukon. I'm also wondering, is there any reports of Ichneumonas in any of the runs in Russia or other areas that are on the Pacific Rim? Have there been any reports of having the same issue there? I'm just trying to understand, is this unique to the Yukon, or is it prevalent to most king salmon that go on longer runs that are out in the Bering Sea?
I can answer that real quick here. If Yukonus is pretty widespread, you know, in the state, you know, we've seen it in other river systems in Southwest Alaska. Recently, you know, I saw it in sockeye from the Kenai River here. And so it is quite common, you know, in fish in our area. It also infects fish in the Pacific Northwest, so, you know, Washington, Oregon, BC. And there's new information out there that it hasn't been published on, but it's in the works, indicating that there is a different strain of the parasite in different areas. So there's a strain that is, you know, further north up in the Bering Sea area, and then through the Gulf of Alaska, versus a strain that's further south and like Sitka Sound and down through, you know, Washington and all that. And so there could be a strain difference, which may account for some of the impact. I don't know about Russia. I just don't know that, and so I won't try to answer that. But what I can say is that it's a common parasite. You know, it's been around for a long time, and usually it doesn't do much harm at the population level, except when there's this perfect storm of events where fish are become heavily infected in the marine environment for whatever reason, and then they make this long migration. I think that long migration is probably one of the reasons why these Yukon fish are more susceptible, you know, that stress. And certainly any warm water years or high flows or other stressful events, it's just fuel to the fire. And so, you know, it's present in other fish in Alaska systems. It just doesn't cause, you know, it doesn't appear to cause the level of associated mortality in those systems, because, you know, those runs have been, you know, they're not as bad, and yeah, they're infected, but, you know, there doesn't seem to be an association with a decline there. So, for whatever reason, it seems to be more impactful in the Yukon, but it's, you know, there are some strain differences in the parasite, but then it's also the Yukon itself is a big, complex, you know, river system that they have to run the gauntlet there. So I think that does have something to do with it.
Hi, Karma. This is Sonia Sager.
Yes. Go ahead, Karma.
Hi, this is Sonia. I'm sitting here, and I'm recalling long, long ago when, before I was married to my husband, he was really excited to teach me about Ichthyophonus. We had a date. So, not that I, you know, I am the last person to frown upon science or to suggest that we shouldn't study it, especially the water temperatures, which we can study without killing Chinook.
But I have to put in my 10 cents here. It's very important to me and to my family. It's we have voluntarily not fished for several years in the last couple decades, you know, and we have foregone fishing entirely some summers. The last time we fished, of course, was in 2020. We got 28 Chinook, which a quarter of were female, I believe. I'd have to look at my records, but we shared a quarter of those fish also with community members. We just ate the last jar of that fish on solstice with much sadness and a little bit of ceremony because we, you know, our whole family works to jar this fish and everybody has kind of a job to do with it and the skills are passed on, everything from how to set the net. And we've been using very small mesh, trying to catch the smallest fish, et cetera, you know. And it's so painful for me because when I hear, you know, Fred West speaking and others, what I'm actually hearing is that your data is more important to you than our way of life. And I was born here in Eagle. I feel like I have a right to say what I'm about to say, which is that there's nothing right about studying something to death when you're you're setting those 200 fish that would be killed at Eagle Sonar against my ability to, say, teach my son, my 14-year-old son, how to properly cut a fish. You're setting that against my ability to feed my family. It was literally one out of every seven meals that we ate. I wouldn't even have a high IQ if my mom hadn't eaten king salmon probably, you know, the whole time she was pregnant with me. If I hadn't been weaned on it, literally weaned on it, I don't think I would be as smart as I am. And when I look at what you're telling me, I'm seeing if you already know a lot of the things, and we already also know these things about Ichthyophonus and, you know, the stressors and stuff, let's focus on that. Why do you have to kill the prime, as you call them, the survivors, the ones that are strong enough to make it, the prime breeding females in the middle that will be, you know, as the sonar does, they catch them midstream in the nets. You know, those prime fish that we have sacrificed everything to let by. How can you then say to us that you need these for your study, just like the 2018 study, that time it was whether they were male or female. What was the ratio? We said, hey, we can tell the ratio by looking at the salmon. We have lived here long enough to where we know if it's a male or a female. You guys said, no, that won't do. Now, I have no problem with you taking samples from fish. The sonar had one fatality this summer. That is what I heard, one. That's just, you know, incidental. But I'm saying, how can you tell me that you're going to tell these people that work for the sonar that now they're going to kill these fish and their kids are going to watch them kill these fish, but they're not going to be able to fish? And we don't want the fish after it's been killed. It's a way of life that we're fighting for. And there is no way you can tell Canadian, you know, children up in their fish camps that are First Nations children trying to learn their heritage that this data is more important than them having a cultural fish camp this year. Please do not do this again. Please.
I have a follow-up.
Don has a follow-up.
Yeah, so for Fred and Jake, I fished smallmouth net for 10 days last year, caught a whole bunch of Baron Ciscos, and the dead salmon, pink salmon that were in the net, I processed them and found no Ichthyophonus in the heart or liver in any of the fish that I got. So I just want to pass that on to you. They were 5-pound fish, probably.
Any other comments?
So this is just at the proposal stage. This is proposal they're going to present in 2023.
This is Kyle from Bridgeport. I'm not sure if I understood your question, but there shouldn't be any proposals that you can weigh in on for 2023 yet, unless I missed something. Which document are you looking at?
Well, I'll read this report and it says proposed plan. So is this plan not been approved through the state, or has it been approved through the state? For the killing of a fish.
My I may have misunderstood where you were at in the conversation. It looks like Zach's got his hand up and can speak to that. I'll take myself back up to mute and try and wait till there's a clear question.
Hey, folks. I know it's dark on the screen. My name is Zach Lohr. I'm the research coordinator for the Black Department of Fish and Game Commercial Fish Division for the AYK region. Try and comment on a couple of points that have been raised. I guess, first and foremost, the flyer that Fred circulated before the meeting, we did use the term proposed, trying to help articulate that nothing's set in stone as far as methodology goes. We've identified a research question that is shared by other agencies, and as far as we understand, shared by a lot of stakeholders. We know that the run sizes are small. We know that we don't have a clear understanding as to what's causing it. We know that there is a reasonable likelihood hypothesis that fish are dying en route along the migratory route to potentially for a couple of different reasons, with ichthyophobia leading hypothesis that explains the differences that Greg discussed in 2020 and 2021. So for that reason, the focus of this research is to try and understand what is happening to these fish so that they can be managed in a way that allows fish to continue in perpetuity, or at least for this information to be considered when making those types of responsible management decisions. Unfortunately, and I do want to recognize much of what Sonia said, we do have a tremendous amount of information about ichthyophobia. You're absolutely right. The one thing that we do not have, which is the one reason that Eagle is such a critical potential sampling location for this project, is we do not have a clear way to connect ichthyophobia disease in any given year to what that means as far as mortality. So what needs to happen in order to answer that question, if we decide that this is a question that is worth sacrificing fish, what needs to happen is to establish those critical lethal thresholds, which unfortunately we just don't have at this point in time. As far as the research question goes, this is one that we're hoping that the short-term sacrifice is well worth that answer, so that it can be considered in future management decisions and help guide future research to better understand what's happening, not just on an annual basis, but the implications for long-term productivity. There's nothing about us conceptualizing the research question and beginning to put together a proposed research plan that attempts to compare the validity of one harvest versus another. That's not in any way what we're attempting to articulate here. As far as using the Eagle sonar platform as a potential location for sample collections, I want to be clear, this is this is kind of our first attempt at trying to identify what could be feasible in this particular area. We're open to other ideas. We're open to working with folks to develop other ways to get these samples, share these samples, get the maximum benefit out of the samples. So I know when I kicked this conversation off, part of what he articulated was a desire to introduce this idea, which I think he and Dina and JD did a very nice job but then also respectfully request that we work together to identify a time to have a much more robust conversation about how we can work together to solve this problem of understanding the implications of ichthyophonus on mortality, on border passage, and what that means for management and production of the stock. So anyway, those were just some thoughts that I wanted to share with the group. And then also to clarify that the term proposal is simply our proposed plan to those that we are talking to, not a formal proposal that they're asking, you know, like a larger body to approve at this time. It's a discussion proposal. Hopefully that helps.
Karma, this is Mike. I'd like to comment again.
Okay.
If I may. Okay, so
yeah, go ahead.
I think one thing we need to be aware of when we're developing any sort of research plan is, you know, I think what we tend to do is we get wrapped around the axle with numbers, and we don't look at the species itself and what it means to the people. And I think we need to, you know, look at, you know, just have some reverence for the species itself. And I think that that's something that we're losing as we go along here. And it's just, it's something to really kind of consider as we, you know, move forward and studying anything. Is just because we're not all scientists and we don't all understand when we talk about all these figures and everything. I can understand what the research question is. I think that in years where we have really low abundance and people have sacrificed so much, and up here in the upper river, you know, we don't have the amount of fish that they do in other parts of the drainage. So the amount of respect that we have for fish that we harvest is extremely high. So I think when you get people's emotion, you can sense people's emotions a lot of times, and I think that's where that's coming from. When people have been asked to give up so much for so many years, it is a way of life. And it's not just numbers on a graph sort of thing. So I think, you know, and moving forward, I think that if you were to, in years where we do have an abundance of fish, if that were to ever occur again, we need to collaborate with the subsistence harvesters to collect these samples and not just do it at, you know, specific projects throughout the drainage. I think you would get a lot more valuable data. It may take some more effort and it may take some, you know, training or, you know, it would definitely be a change. But I think you would get a lot more valuable data and a lot more support if you were to just not do it at their individual project. So that's something that we really need to explore. And you know, as a subsistence harvester, you know, I spend time on the river with my family, and it's the amount of reverence that we have for these fish is real. And, you know, every time that we're checking the net for our family, you know, we get a fish coming in, we're saying Mati Cho to that fish as it's coming in the boat. So it's just when we're developing these different plans, it is you just really need to take that into consideration. So, and I'm happy to have this opportunity to comment early in the process so that we can hopefully get to some understanding down the line. So thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Andy, I have a quick comment.
Yes.
Thank you. So, you know, I feel for both sides of this conversation. I totally agree with what Mike and Sonia and others in Eagle are saying about the hardship and what it means to see these fish killed in the name of science. I also understand that for management, they're looking long-term at how are we going to conduct our management of Yukon River fisheries to allow for any subsistence harvest if we don't have information to understand what the dropout is between Pilot and Eagle. The question in my mind becomes, what can we do about it? You know, if the bonus is going to be there, some years it's going to be strong, some years it's not going to be strong. Some years it's going to have a big impact. Some years it's not going to have a big impact. I mean, if you look at the history of the fisheries, that's the way it seems to operate. So I guess the real question becomes a management question. How tight do we want managers to be able to manage to make sure that they can allow some subsistence harvest and still meet treaty obligations? And to me, the bottom line is the most important thing is we have to get fish back up to a spawning ground long term. And if we're not able to do that, then every time we do not reach proper escapement goals, then we are hurting the run long term. And that's contributing to the situation we're in right now. So it's a very difficult situation. I don't think we're going to solve it. But I think that the bigger questions that we need to think about moving forward is, what are some of the alternatives that we can do for sampling, such as what Mike brought up? And really, what are the management implications long term? What are managers going to be able to do with this information? If you do not collect information really well every year, then you think you're managing with a number when in fact you're not. And I think that's why we failed to meet a statement a number of years. I think managers do the very best they can with the information they have. But if they don't have really accurate information in harvest, ichneophonus, many other things, then these years where they're trying to what we call surgically manage the fisheries, we fail. Because some of the information, the data being used isn't maybe as accurate as we'd like it to be. And that's no fault of managers. That's just, this is an incredibly complicated fisheries with a lot of moving parts and a lot of information we don't know. So I just like to basically say, I think this is a good start. I think we need to talk about it more. And we really need to start discussing what is the end game that we want to do. How do we want to use this information to manage our fisheries long-term for the benefit of the fish, primarily, and then the benefit of the fishermen, secondary? That's all I have. Thank you.
Earlier, this is Karma. Fred mentioned possibly having another meeting where all we talk about is ichthyophonus. Do you guys feel like that would be beneficial? Because this is such a complicated stuff. I mean, it's because everyone, we need to obviously know more.
Just because I still don't know if this is a proposal or are they doing it with or without it.
So it's actually on the table that we can maybe plan a meeting where all we talk about is this.
I think it's very clear that we need a lot more time to discuss this. So yes, I think we need another
group discussion with staff from ADF and G and whomever was involved at that end, and then our AC. So, you know, we're not going to solve this problem tonight, and I think it's good to just walk away from it with this. This is a really good start to get things out on the table and then come back and have some constructive discussion on methodology for this.
Thank you, Andy. I'm not sure really who's commenting from ADF and G. I know Fred did the kind of brought up this plan. So does that sound good to you guys?
Madam Chairperson, this is Sonia. It does sound good to us. I still think that we do need, you know, time to discuss it as an AC as well. Instead of just listening to the proposal, I think we should update ourselves as to where the proposal is and, you know, how it's moving along. But I think we need time to discuss it as an AC amongst ourselves to figure out what people's opinion is. Because I put mine out there. I've heard several people's, but I definitely haven't heard from half of the AC on their opinion of killing fish at the sonar killing Chinook. So I need to know more about what the other members of the AC think before, you know, trying to move a resolution through, which is ultimately our goal, to have a resolution go through opposing lethal sampling.
Thank you, Sonia. I guess what I was trying to get at is there's a lot more information and questions I think we can take from here. Think about questions that we have and then bring it back to a session possibly with ADF and G to get more answers to questions, and then the AC can maybe make a decision on that. I'm just throwing this out there, so whatever anyone thinks.
Carmen, this is Zach with Fishing Day.
Yes.
I'm wide open to whatever the AC would like to do to move forward with the conversation. One thing I was thinking that maybe our team could do to help is to pull together some additional materials beyond kind of the general material of the flyer that we share that articulates in addition to just what we think is the need for the research, but options in which we think we can work together to pull it off in a way that is most acceptable both to the community's goals as well as to the research management goals for a project like this. So there's, as I mentioned when I was discussing with Mike, there is a lot of options for flexibility on how we proceed. The disease is cyclical in nature. We think that it's kind of at a peak right now, so while it is time sensitive, we absolutely should take the time to figure out how best to do a project like this in a way that's most respectful and gets the most out of the collective effort. Comment that was made a little bit ago about, you know, are we doing this or, you know, we can't do this alone. You know, this has to be a collaborative effort. The community needs to be involved in pulling it off successfully. So we need to take the time necessary. So I'm happy to work with our team to put some stuff down on paper, articulate where there's, like, what the needs of the study are and where we see flexibility both in the timing as well as methods of sample collection, distribution and sharing options, ways to leverage subsistence fishing efforts, et cetera, and then maybe propose some dates. I know a lot of us are going to be occupied over the coming weeks with Yukon River panel efforts, but early to mid-February, I know that many of our staff would have time to re-engage on this as detailed as you would like. So I'm wondering if maybe we could provide that to you guys and then propose some times to get back together.
That sounds good to me. How do you guys feel about that?
Good.
Okay. Yes, that sounds good. Is that good, Sonia and Mike?
This is Sonia. Yeah, I do, I appreciate that, but on the other hand, we, you know, some community members, like I can only speak for myself at this point, are not interested in pulling it off successfully. What I'd like to see is Fish and Game change their proposal to include working with subsistence fishers to collect the samples, just like what Mike was kind of talking about. And we've done some of that, you know, in the past, like with sheepish otolith sampling with Randy Brown, and it worked great. And so I don't, you know, I don't want to be gifted dead fish that were, you know, killed in this effort. I don't want to be part of this at all. So if they could please this time, you know, take, last time I really made my objections known and I was just bulldozered. And it really came home to me when a picture of my boat was used in their flyer with my family in the boat, and they didn't know it. And that was their flyer to explain to me why they had to kill the fish, you know, so I could attend the meeting to get it rammed down my throat. And I'm not interested in that reoccurring, basically.
I appreciate that. And the options that I'd like to discuss are just those options. Thanks for that, Sonia.
Well, and my understanding is that there is willingness to possibly work with subsistence fishermen to get samples, and but all of that is pretty new. So if we can possibly just maybe hear like what ADFNG has to say and then negotiate after that what would work out best for everyone, I think would be the best way.
Zach, I'm taking notes here on the meeting. Were you saying that mid to late February your staff would have time to meet again?
Oh, I think it could be earlier than that, Andy. This is a high priority discussion for me and the UConn research team. So as soon as panel's over, I'd be happy to re-engage. So does that help?
Madam Chair, I'd make a recommendation that we meet with ADFNG to have another meeting in February to discuss it in the bonus sampling project.
I agree. Do we need to make a motion?
Well, that would be a motion.
Oh, okay. Jackie Palmer seconds it. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Do we want to set a date now?
I think let's leave that up to ADFNG. When you feel like you guys are ready and everything, let's go ahead and contact Karma and let's schedule a meeting and make it happen.
For that. And Karma, forgive me for not knowing the process. Should I work through Kyle or you to start nailing down a date that might work for folks? I'm happy to start that process as early as possible to identify a meeting date.
You can contact me directly if you'd like, and he has my contact information.
Excellent. Thank you very much for taking the time tonight. I really, really appreciate it. We'll be in touch soon.
Thank you.
One final comment. In all my years on an AC, I have never had this many ADFNG fish biologists and game biologists at one meeting at one time. So I was, I'm taking notes on names, and I can honestly say I've never seen this many people participate. I think that's a great thing. I appreciate that. I just wanted to point that out. I guess it just reflects how important all of this is to everyone. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so I had fishery salmon under old business just for any general comments. This meeting is getting longer and longer. So is there any more comments on fish at this point? I know we can go on all day about fish, but if any important comments that we need to make on fisheries with
This is Bill from Board Support, and I just wanted to reiterate what I shared earlier. Just to keep in mind that the proposal deadline should your advisory committee want to submit proposals on next year's Board of Fisheries meeting cycle, which will include the AYK, the Arctic Yukon Cousins Region, as well as some statewide management. So that call for proposals is now out. I've shared that information. I sent it to you and the other members earlier this evening. It's up on the Board of Fisheries website, and I'd be happy to help work with you and connect you with some of the other fish biologists that are on this meeting now. If you plan to submit proposals, just please bear in mind that proposal deadline to submit proposals is April 11th for the Board of Fisheries for next year. So there would be this coming April for the 2023 Board of Fisheries meeting cycle. And I'll send that information again if you didn't receive it.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so any more comments on fish salmon for right now?
Hi, Karma. This is Dina John with the Alaska Heartland Fishing Game. I'll just kind of briefly remind folks, Serena posted in the chat that the Yurts for preseason meeting will be on March 24th in Anchorage. She'll be sending out a registration form, and there'll also be a virtual option. And then in terms of for Yukon River management, both the summer and fall season summaries have been published. I can put up a link to the summer season summary that came out a while ago. And then Christy Gleason, I believe, may also be online if she wants to add anything about the recently published fall season summary. And yeah, we're both online if anyone has any more questions.
Thank you.
And hi, this is Christy Gleason, fall season manager. If anyone has any questions, you can feel free to reach out to myself or Dina. We can put our contact information in the chat. And that way we don't take up too much of your meeting unless you have specific questions.
Thank you. Okay, so not hearing any more comments, we'll move on. And so we'll go back to the Moose survey update.
All right, thanks. Thank you, Karma. You can hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and share my screen again if that's okay. Okay, can you guys see the PowerPoint?
Yes, we can.
Okay, and I should have clarified before just to people who I am. I think I know most of you guys there, but just a reminder, I'm the assistant marine biologist here in the TOPA. So I'm just going to run over briefly kind of a brief update for Moose for Unit 20E and then talk briefly about the antlerless moose proposal that I talked to you guys about back in August. So just to start off with, just a brief update on reported harvest for Unit 20E, and this is a long time span going all the way back to 2005, but this is just total reported harvest by year. So yellow represents the registration moose permit harvest, so that's RM865, and that obviously encompasses most of the Unit 20E moose harvest. Green is the general harvest ticket, and the little white portions is just a little bit of harvest we get from our winter draw hunts. So the 2021 harvest was pretty similar to 2020 and 2017 and 2018. You know, more or less, it's been fairly stable since about 2014. Long-term trend is this, you know, increasing trend, but fairly stable since about 2014. And then just to jump right into the moose survey, you know, I showed you guys this map before, but it's been a while. So this, we've concentrated our survey efforts for the last quite a few years within the southern portion of the unit. And since 2014, mostly within what I'm calling here the Taylor Corridor moose survey area. So this yellow star is Chicken. So it's more or less south of Chicken along the Taylor Highway. And this is where most of the concentrated harvest within Unit 20E occurs, is within this area, the most concentrated moose harvest. Now, the graph I'm going to show you is going to be specific to this Taylor Corridor analysis area. But basically, the reason I focus in on that is that it encompasses the overlap of the area we've surveyed since 2014 and the areas we overlapped going back all the way to 2004. And so essentially it encompasses this area, which began along the area. So just jumping right into it, on this graph, I show estimated moose densities. And all these graphs are going to go from 2005 to 2021. So the white diamonds are estimated observable moose densities, and this is moose per square mile. And the yellow squares are the estimates corrected for sightability. We estimated sightability during these 3 years specifically. So overall, the long-term trend has been an increasing trend. And it's approximately doubled 2005 to around 0.7 moose per square mile. And around 2020, we're around 1.4 moose per square mile. So approximately doubled. And what this equates to in the long-term trend, within this area, it equates to an increase of about 75 moose per year over the long trend. Now you'll notice our 2021 estimate, the midpoint estimate was lower. It is about 1.1 moose per square mile. The confidence intervals overlap. So, you know, one thing we can potentially say that we have 5 years of surveys in a row, perhaps this long-term intrusive trend has stabilized. You know, I think it's easy to look at this data point from 2021 and think that, oh man, the population has decreased. So this overlap of confidence intervals, we can't say that there's been a decrease. And, you know, perhaps there's something strange going on with this year's survey. So we'll see after the next survey. However, you know, potentially things have stabilized here recently. But as always, more years of data will be useful. Now, the increase in the population has largely been the result of an increase in the cow component of the population as opposed to the bull component of the population. In this graph, the top yellow diamonds are estimated cow densities, and the yellow line is the long-term linear trend, and the white squares at the bottom are estimated bull densities. So the cow densities increased at about just under 6% per year through 2020. That equates to about 60 cows per year within that area. The bull component, it did increase. However, really since about 2012, it's been fairly stable. And, you know, the bull component, it's limited by, bulls have higher natural mortality to begin with, and then obviously bulls are the components that are currently harvested out of the population. And this difference in growth rates has led to lower bull-cow ratios during recent years. So in this graph, I show bull-cow ratio. Those are the white diamonds. These are 90% confidence intervals around the estimates. And the yellow lines are our management objectives for that southern portion unit 20E, which we've worked with the AC and TOC, and also discussed with you guys to reduce that management objective. And there's a few reasons for that, but I won't go into that now. But basically, the short summary here is that, you know, recently bull cow ratios have been hovering slightly above the objective in upper 20s to lower 30s. And then finally, this graph shows calf-cow ratios, same time span, 2005 to 2021. You know, the general theme here is that following the fires, 2005 to 2010, we had fairly high calf-cow ratios. Since then, overall, they've been lower. With the exception of 2019, we had a real high calf-cow ratio. But the past 2 years, it's been lower, and this year specifically, we did have a lower calf-cow ratio. So just to summarize what we're seeing, you know, we have this long-term increasing trend. Perhaps it's stabilized recently. Cow component is increasing at a faster rate than the bull component. and both our ratio is stable, slightly above the objective, and the cap car ratio has been lower than average this year and last year. So I'm going to kind of keep going here, and I'm going to transition to talk about this proposal, and then we can kind of discuss any questions you guys have when I'm done, if that works for you guys. So the just to bring up to speed on the proposal itself, so when I talked to you guys in August, we as a department had submitted an agenda change request for the Antlers Moose proposal, Unit 20E. So the Board of Game met in November. They accepted that agenda change request, so it's going to be discussed at the statewide meeting in March. So now it's an actual proposal, and so it's Proposal 270 at the statewide meeting in Fairbanks in March. So just to fill you in on what this proposal would do and to show you a map of the area, this proposal would establish antlerless moose hunting seasons within the southern portion of Unit 20E, and specifically within this area shown in orange on the map on the left. So here's Chicken, so generally south of Chicken. And this orange area encompasses about 25% of the entire Unit 20E. The proposal includes two different hunt types, and we worked closely, especially with the AC, Upper Canada 40 Mile AC, that developed these two different hunt types. One is youth prominent, season dates August, and portion after the regular season, late October into November. Per the definition of a youth draw hunt, it would be open to resident and non-resident youth. However, non-resident youth would have to be accompanied by a resident, basically legal guardian. Up to 100 total permits, any antlerless moose except cows with calves. And then the second hunt type would be a regular draw hunt. Season dates restricted to just later in October into November. Open to residents only, up to 400 permits. And I know this total number of permits sounds scary. I'll touch on that later. And the same day limit. The goals of the proposal are threefold. The first is to basically slow population growth. So the primary goal is to maintain the high nutrition levels and habitat in good shape, and the sustainable long-term yield that we're currently getting from this population. Second goal is to use antlerless harvest to provide additional sustainable hunting opportunity, which could help meet IM harvest objectives. And then the third one, and this is the big one, is to provide management flexibility to the department to rapidly respond to potential future changes in nutrition. And the big difference from this antlerless proposal compared to other areas is that we're trying to take a proactive approach to antlerless harvest as opposed to a reactive approach. So the approach that's been taken in many other areas for antlerless moose harvest is a reactive approach. So, for example, waiting for nutrition decline in the population before implementing or thinking about antlerless harvest. And you know, there's examples from this, for example, south of Fairbanks in Unit 20A. There's a lot of reasons why these other areas took this reactive approach. However, there's issues, and it's there can be long-term implications for the population for waiting for the nutrition decline. And so by being proactive, we're trying to get ahead of the curve, maintain the population at a high nutritional level below carrying capacity. And so just to show you all that moose survey data, how that overlaps with the proposed area. So this black hash area is the moose survey data I just summarized, and then shown underneath it in orange is the antlerless, the proposed antlerless moose hunt area. So essentially that moose survey data I summarized encompasses most of the proposed antlerless hunt area. The one bit of data I haven't shown yet is twinning rates. So twinning rates are a commonly used index to nutrition for moose. It's never easy to, for example, go out and measure specific nutritional levels of individual animals, and there can be also challenges. You know, we can do other things like measure browse and stuff, but a twinning rate is a fairly affordable, easy thing to do over the long term. So here we have the annual twinning rates from Unit 20E, and this yellow line at 20%, that's kind of a cautionary line where if you start seeing twinning rates below 20%, that means that nutrition or habitat might potentially be increased. So, as you can see, for the most part, we've been above that 20% line, and our long-term average is 30%. In our recent, we also look at three-year averages just to even out some of this variation. So our most recent three-year average was 39%. So 39% is well above 20%. And that, you know, begs the question, well, why are we, again, why are we thinking about antlerless harvest when our this index to nutrition is in pretty good shape? And there's a few things to keep in mind there. First, training rate, leg is a reflection of nutrition. So this 2021 training rate, that reflects what happened in the population over the last few years that led to that training rate this year. So it's not an instantaneous reflection. It encompasses what's happened in the past. So by the time you start seeing reduced training rates, basically you're becoming reactive at that point. By that point, you have reduced nutrition in the population, and you're bumping up against it in the past. So the goal of this proposal is we want to maintain these high training rates and good nutrition levels. And as you guys know, we've looked at this map before, but the reason we still have good training rates, despite the population doubling, is a lot of this area burned in 2004 specifically. So these areas shown in red are areas that burned in 2004, and it was about just over 40% of the proposed antelope hunt area burned during that year. So these burns, they're 18 years old. The length of time that burns benefit moose in terms of habitat varies. It varies widely depending on a variety of factors. However, generally, you know, 10 to 30 years is that sweet spot. This habitat is probably not going to get any better than it is right now. At some point, it's going to start decreasing in quality. And we do have a browse survey planned for this March. So that will kind of give us a more real-time assessment of habitat for this moose population. And so just to summarize, and this is just the last couple slides here, then I'll be done. You know, main goals of this proposal, slow the population growth if it's needed in order to maintain these high nutritional levels and this high sustainable yield, to give the Department of Management the flexibility to make incremental but these real-time changes to antlerless harvest in response to nutritional indices and population growth rates. And it's important to keep in mind that we're going to take a very conservative approach to determining harvest quotas and permit numbers unless nutritional indices decline. But that's where that up to language of permit numbers allows for the management flexibility to rapidly respond to potential changes. So if we only ask for up to 20 permits and we start seeing declines in nutrition, then we'd have to go back to the board again and say, hey, we want to issue more than 20 permits. So by having an up to language of more than 20 permits, for example, we can make those changes more quickly. And then finally, you know, I think it's important to think about, okay, what are the risks of waiting and not going forward with this more proactive approach? And, you know, the first thing I'll say is that there's a potential that that this population may never reach carrying capacity. You know, there's some evidence the population has stabilized recently. And given what we saw this year in terms of our estimate, our abundance estimate, and also our calf-cow ratios recently, even if this is passed, we're probably not going to rush into this antlerless harvest because of what we've seen over the last year in terms of our numbers. So, you know, potentially this population may never reach tank capacity. However, if these long-term growth rates do continue, our ability to stabilize or reduce the population, if nutrition becomes an issue, can be hampered by social or logistical problems. And we've seen this in other areas where, you know, it can be tough to figure out. For example, 20E, some of these areas are remote, and it's going to be tough. It's going to take some time to figure out how to effectively harvest antlerless moose out of some of those more remote areas. And also, if we waited, nutrition becomes an issue. We might take more severe management actions, such as a larger influx of hunters. And this, you know, the big thing we've seen, again, areas near Delta Junction and Fairbanks. And then last, you know, if nutrition declines, it can have very long-lasting impacts on the population and the habitat. And again, we're still seeing these impacts in areas around Delta Junction and Fairbanks. So just as far as the pieces of the puzzle, these are some things to think about. So that's all I had on moose. And thanks for taking the time of having questions. Again, this is one of those proposals you guys will probably discuss as part of it, or might want to discuss as part of the statewide proposal, and it's Proposal 270.
Herm, I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Jeff. Where is the TOC Advisory Committee standing on the antlerless moose harvest program?
Yeah, that's a good question, Andy. So they met and discussed statewide proposals last month, and they voted unanimously for this proposal. And you guys could certainly ask for their minutes if you want, but basically what it came down to is they see the benefits of taking a proactive approach, but they definitely want it to be conservative. They obviously don't want us to rush in in terms of larger outlet harvest. The other thing that they talked about was, so the ACs, for these antlerless goose hunts, the ACs get a chance to vote on them every year. So it's not the regular cycle where it's every 3 years. And so I think that gave them some comfort as well in that if we start going out on a limb or in a direction that they don't like, this is something that is revisited by the board game every year.
And a quick follow-up, Jeff, on the antlerless moose, is that open to non-resident hunters as well as resident hunters?
So, and this, again, is everything, it would be up to the Board of Game to decide. Part of the framework that we came up with, this is largely AC, Upper Canada, 40-mile AC that came up with it, was that the regular draw hunt would be resident only. The youth draw hunt, just because the definition of youth hunt is open to resident and non-resident youth, but again, non-resident youth have to be accompanied by a resident legal guardian, essentially. So it's a pretty limited pool of non-resident youth that might qualify for that.
Thank you.
Nate had a question.
Yeah, Jeff, what do you anticipate the success rate of this hunt will be, the harvest rate?
Success rate in terms of, for example, issued 10 permits, how many people might harvest a moose?
Yeah, exactly. I'm seeing 500 permits up there. If 500 permits were issued, how many cows do you think would be harvested?
Yeah, so first of all, we have absolutely no plans to issue 500 permits. The reason that UPU language is included is to give that flexibility in the future if we saw new declines in nutrition. But general rule of thumb, and this comes from some areas around Fairbanks that are somewhat similar, so like Unit 20D north of Fairbanks, the Fairbanks manager said that typically about 50% of people that get permits hunt, and then about 50% of those people harvest moose, and that's a kind of a general rule of thumb. So let's say if you need 20 permits total, by that math, 10 people would hunt and 5 might harvest a moose. And what we were thinking originally, and this was before we had our moose savory results in this last fall, was shooting for, less than 1% of the population, so around 20 cows or so. Again, I think we're going to approach it more.
I don't remember it being open-ended, and I don't remember the numbers being that high. Am I looking at it wrong, the permit? I mean, we were totally against it, but I don't remember it being open-ended to where it was left up to Fishing Game to make the decision on if they're going to use it or not going to use it, and the amount of money that they're shooting now or proposing.
Yeah, this is John. I don't think that we had a number for permits at that time. There wasn't up to 400. It was just that they were talking about this is a possibility and this is what could happen if the 20 rates stay the same and stuff like that. I would like to point out, though, that the success rate of the hunt around Fairbanks can't compare the success rates in 20E in the remote areas that's not along the Taylor Highway, because Fairbanks has so many trail systems compared to us on the upper left remote
section of 20 East South. That's basically going to be fly-in stuff.
Right. Yeah, so much of that is inaccessible.
But, and that's what I'm wondering, because in that meeting that we had that day, because that was a concern we had, this is going to turn into nothing but a big guidance sermon.
Yes.
Okay. I'm just trying to remember. I can't find my notes, and I apologize, but I've taken a lot of notes on that when we were here.
You know, if they're going to have an Atlas Mouton, and it's supported by the different ACs except us, then I suggest that they focus on the youth time and not open it up to 400 permits for the regular draw hunt and see how it goes. You know, and if they're going to take a conservative approach, open it up to youth time and see what happens, you know. But these 400 permits for the regular draw hunt seems a little bit out there. And I'm sure they're not proposing that, they're just saying up to that.
But it's there. I mean, once you put it in paper,
yeah,
up to that number.
Yeah.
I apologize. I just can't find my notes from that meeting. I knew there was some of this stuff in there that we spoke about.
Karma, this is Mike. I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was unable to attend the meeting in August, and I'm curious to know what the Eagle AC, what was the overall feeling for this hunt? Did you come to any conclusions?
We opposed it.
Okay.
Yeah, unanimously.
Yeah. Okay, that's good, because I just, I've been jotting some thoughts down here, and I'm just like, I think this overall is a bad idea. It's going to draw in a lot more hunters to the Taylor Highway, which we already are having issues with that. And, you know, I think it could lead to some big swings in the population. And, this winter is, so far, it's, you know, looks like it's has the potential to be super hard on moose. You know, I think we're beginning to see that in areas around Fairbanks and Delta. And we didn't get that ice event that they did, but their snow is pretty deep out here. So I think we need to take in that into consideration. Yeah, so those are some of my thoughts.
Is there a comment period on that?
No. I guess I have a question, Karma, and that is, this is a presentation by Jeff on what's being proposed. RAC has already voted at the previous meeting not to support this. Is there a motion on the table, or will there be a motion on the table to reconsider this, or is this basically just an informational presentation by Jeff to us? I guess I'm confused where we're at in the meeting in regards to this topic.
And Karma, do you mind if I...
Is this an action item right now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If I add just something to Andy's question?
Go ahead.
Yeah, and Andy, you're absolutely right. You guys voted on it in August. And I think the difference then is that it wasn't an actual proposal. And so I think whether you guys do it now or when you guys talk about statewide proposals, this particular proposal might be one that you guys might want to vote on, because when you guys voted on it in August, it wasn't an actual proposal. And so if you guys want your... you know, comments to me submitted to the Board of Game, then at some point it would be worth you guys be pretty voting on that. Would be my thought.
Thank you for that clarification, Jeff.
This is Kyle from Board of Game, and Jeff's got it correct. Jeff makes my life really easy.
Thank you, Jeff. yeah, that's right. And so, Andy, if you look in that minutes template that you've got the editable version of for recording, and then not trying to get everyone else to jump ahead on the agenda, but 270 should be in there. That's the last proposal in that whole list, and that was one of the agenda change requests that was presented to the Board of Game back in November and was accepted to be taken up for consideration as a full proposal at the statewide meeting that's coming in March. So that's the one that the comment deadline for on-time comments is February 18th. And because that one may not have been included in some of the previous supplemental proposal packets that have been posted online, I actually put the link to that proposal. It's the very last page of that. I think the title of the PDF I attached to the notice is the Eagle Ace Meeting Template with Statewide BOG 22 Proposals and ACRs. It's that very last one, Proposal 270. It was formerly called ACR 7. And you can put your comments in there, and as well as the list of votes. That would be the best way to get not just your a synopsis of what's said, but also to understand how many of your members support or oppose that and why. That's really what we're trying to direct ACs to use these minute templates. We put them into a database, and the board members would like to look at the tally of how many people liked them and didn't like them. So it's a useful space.
So, do we want to vote on this?
Yep.
No?
Yep.
Yes.
Karma, I make a motion to oppose the antlerless hunt as proposed.
Let me make a correction. Anytime you make a motion, make it to support it, and then you either support it, or if everybody is opposed to it, then the motion fails.
Okay, thank you, Andy.
So if you'd like to make that motion to support Proposal 270, that would be the proper way to do it.
Okay, I make a motion in support of Proposal 270.
I'll second it.
Don, would you second it? All those in favor?
Wait a minute. There needs to be discussion, because we need to also make comments on why we are either supporting it or why we are not. So if we can have a little mic, since you made the motion, if you could please speak to the motion, and then that opens it up on the table for any further comments.
Okay, I'm going to speak to the motion. I believe that the cow hunt or the antlerless hunt will draw in a lot more hunters to the Taylor Highway and compound the problem that we're already seeing with the high amount of hunters along the highway. I foresee a big swings in the population throughout time. This winter, I feel, is going to be super hard on the moose, just based on what I'm seeing. And I think that the antlerless hunt is going to change the hunting culture in the long term. For it's going to be hard to go back to a bull-only type scenario in the future. So those are my thoughts on the proposal. Any other comments?
This is Karma. I would also like to express my concerns for opening up antlerless moose hunting. I just think once we go that way, it'll never go back. I also feel like I just really feel like hunting cows or is just, I don't feel that's good practice. And same thing, just bringing more people into this area, more guiding, and taken away from subsistence and traditional use. Any more discussion? So we'll vote on it. So again, the motion was made a motion to support proposal 270. So all those in favor? Aye. All those opposed?
Aye.
Aye. Motion made.
Aye.
Thanks.
Too late.
So just as a point of clarity or order, was that unanimous opposition?
Correct.
Yeah, unanimous.
Thank you.
Okay, so is there any more comments on that? All right, so we'll move on to the Yukon Charley River compendium.
Thank you, Madam Chair. AC members, this is Marcy Okada, Assistant Coordinator for Yukon Charley Rivers National Preserve. I'm just going to share a quick update on our compendium for the preserve. We'll be seeking public comment on proposed changes to this compendium. A compendium is a written compilation of designations, closures, permit requirements, and other restrictions adopted under the superintendent's discretionary authority. The comment period will be opening this coming Friday, January 14th at 5 p.m., and will be open for 30 days, so it'll end on February 15th. Comments can be shared through the Planning, Environment, and Public Comment, otherwise known as the PEPSI system, and there's going to be a web link. Unfortunately, we don't currently have a news release available, but I'll be sharing that with you folks once one is created, and that'll happen fairly soon, considering that our comment period is opening at the end of the week. So after review and consideration of the need for annual updates, the following changes are being proposed. Superintendent may authorize with or without conditions the collection of dead standing wood in all or a portion of the preserve area. The reason why this is being proposed is it's to ensure the public has a means to provide a heat source for public use cabins and other temporary structures for visitor safety or comfort during times of the year when ground wood may not be available or prevalent. Over the past few years, the compendium hasn't changed, but this is what's being proposed for 2022, and just thought it was timely to share it with the AC due to the fact that the comment period will be opening at the end of the week. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but do you folks have any questions?
Hi, Marcy. This is Don. Who is the acting superintendent?
That's a good question, Don. So currently we have an acting superintendent, and it's Jeff Rasick, who is normally our program manager for resources.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Marcy.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Question, Madam Chair.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. Can you, Marcy? Marcy, can you please identify for us where the pendium can be seen or viewed, either a website or whatever, for people's review?
I can give you a web link right now if folks have pen and paper.
Can you write it? Are you just on the phone? You're not on Zoom, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm strictly just on the phone tonight. Sorry about that.
Go for it, I'll try and talk.
Okay, so it's parkplanning.nts.gov/YUCH_compendium, so that's COMPENDIUM_2022.
Marcy, can you email that to me and I could send it on to the AC members?
Okay, I'll go ahead and do that. And this web link won't go live until Friday at 5 p.m. But I'll forward it on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Okay, so the next on the Denison project, Bruce, can you give a quick overview of that? And then we have the request if our Fish and Game Advisory Committee could possibly put in a letter for that. So can you give us an update on that? Is Bruce still on?
No, Bruce,
yeah, it doesn't look like Bruce is still on, and I believe back in the chat, which again, I'll save the chat at the end of this meeting. I'll share that so you can have that for the minutes as well. But I think there were several folks at around 5:30 that all kind of said they had to take off. Yep, Bruce said that, oh, he's actually, there was a Denison Headwaters meeting at 5:30 today, so that's where he is now.
Okay, so is everyone here, well, the Denison Project, they asked the advisory committee if we would be, so I can read the letter if you'd like. You want me to do that? Okay. The Eagle Fish and Game Advisory Committee would like to voice our formal opposition to the state's current plans to offer land for sale in the greater Denison Headwaters area as part of their remote recreational cabin sites program. We oppose the land sale and related actions as described in the preliminary decision document titled Denison Headwaters Remote Recreation Cabin Site, ADL 420909. DNR shows a very busy time for people in the Upper Canada region when the majority of people here participate in many subsistence activities. For DNR to choose this time frame for public comment from people that this program will affect so dramatically is inappropriate and unjust. The entire project area, as identified in attachment, a vicinity map of the preliminary decision, is the traditional territory of the Upper Chemna region tribes. Tribes in this region are already suffering under increased pressure on their limited infrastructure and competition from highly resourced, non-local resident and non-resident hunters. The project area is the long-standing tribal hunting and berry-picking territory. The increased density of private held lands proposed in the preliminary decision are a direct threat to their traditional and customary uses. We support Northway tribal member Bruce Urban's submitted public comments and the Upper Chemna 40 Mile Advisory Committee letter. We agree with the Upper Chemna 40 Mile AC statement that when it comes to subsistence and recreation, The area that DNR has chosen for this program is absolutely in the middle of the highest use area for residents of the Upper Chandler region. This area is used by people from Santa Cruz, Tokes, Tetlin, and Northway. Some of the uses include wood gathering, mushroom gathering, berry picking, moose hunting, caribou hunting, grouse hunting, bear hunting, and trapping. This area includes portions of three different active trap lines. What this program will do is effectively take this very important area from the local people that use it now and sell it to 35 people that will have ownership in this area. The locals will be displaced. The Equitana residents will lose their multi-generational natural and renewable resources. This will negatively impact six Upper Chandler communities who depend on this area and have a constitutional right per state law to equal access. The Eagle Fish and Game Advisory Committee requests a meaningful tribal consultation and disclosure of how the proposed project area was selected. We also request that public comment period be reopened and that face-to-face meetings be held in the Upper Chandler communities and tribal consultation be performed with the Upper Chandler tribes before anything further is done on this project. So that was, I attended the, Andy and I attended the 40-mile AC, Upper Chandler 40-mile AC, and they gave us, they talked about this and asked for our opposition in it because it's such a important area to all the tribes in that area in the AC. So,
do you have a map, or can someone describe exactly where this is for me? Or maybe not exactly, but close?
Is it the Denison Park Bridge?
It's right, yeah. So it's right in the, I think it's 12 miles out of from where you get on the Taylor Highway. Is that correct? Does anyone else?
Yeah,
that's
way further.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's, Karma, if I can speak up here a little bit.
Yes,
okay.
Please.
Yeah, so it's, I could try to dig up a map to share, but it's generally around mile 12 of Taylor Highway. That's where the, what I call Porcupine Ridge Road cuts off to the west. So the proposed area encompasses the first several miles of that Porcupine Ridge Trail or road on the west, and that also encompasses a little portion to the east side of the Taylor Highway as well.
What mile is that?
So most of that property is highway accessible?
Yes. For the most part. I mean, it's basically, you know, if you can imagine, it's centered along the, there we go, perfect. Oh, we got a map to look at.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't want to cut anyone off, but this was shared by one of the staff from DNR at the first TOPE meeting, the first Upper 40-mile advisory committee meeting earlier this fall, and I can make sure to send this to everybody as well. Is it better if I zoom in or zoom out?
Karma, Andy?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the letter that you just wrote read into the record. Who was that by?
Bruce Irving. He has made a public comment. Yeah.
Got it. I'd like to make a motion, please.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion to support the Eagle AC support the letter written by Mr. Irving, and that we will, yeah, I'll just say we would like to support that letter for right now. Then we'll have some discussion.
No question. Jackie Helmer, second. Is there any discussion?
Who was the second? Jackie?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, thank you. Speaking to the motion, I agree 100% with all points stated in that letter. I believe that 40-mile AC is also adamantly opposed to this project, and I think it would have very negative impacts to even as far-reaching as Eagle. Anytime you start bringing new population bases in, it affects subsistence activities in a very dramatic way. And it was my understanding, listening to some of the presentations at the 40-mile AC, that once those people have that land, they have the ability to keep people off the land. And that directly will impact subsistence harvesters from the region around here. So I am adamantly opposed to that land sale and in full support of that letter written by Mr. Irvin.
Any more discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. I will get that letter out to the Commissioner Corey Thingy.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yes, thank you. Okay. So I guess we need to. I'll also do a letter. After I talk to council, I'll also do a letter from the tribe too. So. So I guess. Well, do we want to go over board proposals at this time?
No, I
think quite frankly, I think it can wait. We spoke on 270 proposal 270. That's pretty critical to us, and I think maybe if we meet with the fisheries people in February, maybe we can also get some of these proposals. I think what I would recommend is that council members look at these proposals, check off which ones they'd like to address, and then get that to the chair, and then the chair can forward that to the appropriate people to speak about the impacts or about these proposals and what they need. That's my recommendation for moving forward, Madam Chair.
Okay. Does that sound good,
Chevron?
Okay.
All I'm concerned is the 18th of February is our deadline. So our meeting would need to happen before then
for voting on the other proposal.
Well, that's just our comment.
This is Kyle again from board support, and that's correct. So on time. Comments are due February 18th for those statewide proposals. So, like that minutes template that Andy's filling out with at least the tally and the comments on proposal number 270, that would be a preferred format to submit those. But you can also submit, you're allowed up to 100 pages to submit in support or opposition of any proposals that will be discussed. Once that deadline has passed, it is helpful that whether the public or advisory committees, they can still submit written comment as it's called the late comments. That process is known as just submitting a record copy, and those are accepted throughout the meeting. So even once the meeting has begun, but those are limited to more than 10 pages. And the strong preference really is that we get advisory committee comments in on time. So if you all wanted to schedule a meeting for early February, usually it's pretty fast if you work through that minutes template. You can sometimes turn around those minutes to get that reflected and submitted within the same week or within a day or two.
Madam Chair, Andy?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I did a preliminary walkthrough on these proposals, and as far as really important ones, there's maybe 8 to 10, and then there might be some others that we might want to take a position on. But I think if we had a meeting mid-February, a few days or so before this deadline. We could probably hammer these out pretty quick, especially if ADFD staff is available to help us understand some of these proposals.
Okay, so hopefully if, do we want to put, maybe do this at the same time as we have the ICTIA phone this meeting? Yeah?
I would say that's up.
Yeah, I would like to, Karma, this is Mike, if we could have it at the same time as the ICTIA phone meeting, that would be good.
So February 18th is a Friday. It's the third week or the third Friday of February, so we would probably want to meet sometime around anywhere from the 14th to the 17th.
Okay, so
how about the 15th, Andy? Karma.
Up to me. Oh, yeah. Well, not the 7th. And not the
13th.
That's capable from. So the 15th? The 15th?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think everyone's good with the 15th. And I could try to work with Zach to see if we can get that meeting on the 15th.
Okay, that would be great.
One thing that will help you move quickly through the proposals on the 15th, especially since it sounds like there are probably going to be some lengthy fisheries discussion, take the phone the same thing project that same day. Karma, we can connect between now and that next meeting. But once you and the other members have had a chance to kind of choose those proposals that are most relevant to your advisory committee, I can kind of shorten down that minutes template that Andy's working on now, and then I can also share a PDF with everyone and mail it out in time so you've got the full proposals for those. I'm guessing there probably won't be more than a dozen or two as opposed to 150 or so. So we can get that out so everyone's got time to really read through that. So plenty of time for discussion, but also kind of slowing down your meeting.
That sounds good. And do we have contact information for that? Did he give that to me? Okay.
I would make a recommendation to all the AC members here to try and get proposals that they would like to discuss to Karma by the end of next week at the latest. So we have time to get that information to the ADFG staff.
By next week?
By the end of next week, if people could get their proposal numbers to you, Carla, and we'll consolidate that, and then we can work off of that. Because we're going to, later on in the month, we're going to get in, and early next month, we're going to get into the quest coming through, and people are going to get really busy and tied up with that. So, sooner the better.
Karma, this is Mike. Along with that, I'd like to send our draft resolution regarding the ICTIA bonus sampling to you, so you have a copy of that as well.
Okay, so I had a few things. If there's no more comments on that, I had to move in Caribou under old business and the Hunter check-in. Do we want to go ahead and talk about those? Is there any comments on moose and caribou at this point? I did want to bring up that we did have it, that we were going to write a letter to the commissioner, but I wondered if the proposal that Tim Simon put together for us, if we just want to go ahead and put that in. I think it's next year is the cycle, but they already aren't. What are your guys' feelings on that? And we can discuss this more when we it's not so late, and we can put it on the next agenda. Would you like to table it till the next?
Yeah.
Can I get a motion?
Yep.
Ben makes the motion to table.
Let's speak.
Did you hear me?
Motion is to table the discussion on the letter written by Jim Simon to be sent to the Board of Fish, I'm sorry, Board of Game, to the next meeting.
Yeah, the proposal.
Yeah.
Steve Robbins, second. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Sorry, I keep going. Okay. All right. And any comments on Hunter check-in?
Just a quick report. Basically, Karma and I listened into the 40-mile, upper 40-mile AC meeting, and I just presented where we're at with the Eastern Regional Advisory Council at the federal program on the hunter ethics, and also asked them if they would consider initiating some programs along the Taylor Highway, whether it be with community members. It didn't sound like ADF&G was that interested. They're pretty swamped, but I was hoping that maybe the residents of Polk would start to gain interest in some of these hunter ethics outreach programs that are being developed. So there was no action taken. It was more informational. And I think we should continue to follow up with that, with the 40-mile AC as well as RAC once our Eastern RAC meets and can give more updates on that. So the general idea is to try and to develop a program at the head of the Taylor Highway for hunter outreach and ethics information along the Taylor Highway to hunters. That's about all I have on that.
Do we need to put that on the next agenda?
I think no, because the next meeting we won't have our Eastern RAC meeting by then, so that'll probably be for future meetings. It'll be ongoing. But I think what might be good, we won't need to discuss it at this next meeting, but maybe we could just put it on as an agenda item under old business. And then if we have something up to update on it, we can. If not, then we'll just move on to the agenda. So maybe we can just put that on our template.
Sounds good. Okay. No miscellaneous business, then I'll just get a motion to adjourn.
I'll make the motion to adjourn.
Don Woodruff makes the motion to adjourn. Jackie Helmer seconds it. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
I'm sorry, guys. So our next meeting will be February 15th. I'll talk to Zach with ADF&G and we'll plan for that.
Thank you,
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, and I'll try and get the recording for this meeting posted by Wednesday, by tomorrow afternoon. And thank you, Andy, for the stride.
Yep. All right. Good meeting. Thank you. Appreciate your support.
Yeah.
Question on the on that list of all the different proposals. I hadn't spent a lot of time with it yet, but is there a way for me to just modify that as you sent it, or does it need to be changed to a different file format?
You should be able, so I sent you if you've got Microsoft Word or something that opens Microsoft Word on your computer, you should be able to open the Word document I sent you. I posted a PDF of the same thing onto the public notice, just because it's a little easier when you post them to online public notice that way. But you should be able to just go in and edit. You can delete whole rows if you want to, if you're not going to be taking any action on it. Or you can fill out a long comment in that comment field. So if you have any trouble with it, just let me know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think that's what it was, is I basically just transferred it from my phone over to the computer, and it was in PDF format, and I couldn't do anything with it, so...
I'll send you the document version again. So,
yeah, I have the PDF. Yeah, the Word one will help. Thank you. All right, take care. Time to feed the dogs. They're hungry.
I bet. Okay. Well, take care.
Bye bye.
Thanks. Have a good night.
Thanks, Carmen. This worked really well. I'd say this is one of the most productive meetings that I've gotten to host.